Welcome to episode 14 of The Infectious Myth. Today, I'm very proud to have as a guest Dr. Harold Illman. Everybody who has studied biology, even to a high school level, has seen pictures of the internal structure of a cell or other microscopic biological bodies, such as viruses. Many of the structures we see have names like endoplasmic reticulum or Golgi. And we learn about the probable function of these structures. Researchers study them. Drugs are planned based on the impact on them. But today's guest, Dr. Harold Illman, has been saying for a long time, since at least 1970, that what we are seeing is an artifact of the process of killing the cell so that it can be observed under a light microscope or an electron microscope. Welcome to The Infectious Myth, Dr. Illman.
Thank you.
It's very good to have you here. Probably not everybody who's listening to this program is familiar to how specimens need to be prepared, but always with an electron microscope and quite often with a light microscope. So what does it take in order to prepare a specimen so that it can be seen better under those microscopes?
Well, first of all, you have to kill the animal, which you take the cell out of. And
right.
That causes considerable changes in the biochemistry of the cells. Secondly, you have to cut out the particular organ.
Right.
And then while you do this, this takes away the oxygen supply and the glucose supply from the cells. So that also changes them. And then you fix them. Fix is killing them. It's pickling them, in fact. When
right.
you pickle them, this kills the cells. So you're actually looking at dead cells. And the next thing you do is to dehydrate them. When you dehydrate them, they're about 90% water. So obviously you take up to 90% of their contents out, they're no longer the same as they were when they started.
So a cell that we look at under a powerful microscope might only be 10% of its actual real size, and the shapes of what's inside it and the shape of the cell itself might have changed considerably?
Considerably, yes. I mean, if, for example, you took just as an analogy, if you took a grape and examined a raisin, although a raisin is originally a grape, the raisin is completely different in its chemistry, in its structure, in its grooves, in its taste, in its biochemistry, and everything about it is different from the original cell because you have dehydrated it.
Right. I presume that the color changes that occur in a raisin are due to chemical changes that occur as it's drying. It's not just a dry grape. It's actually changed chemically.
No, it dries and it oxidizes.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that water leaves it means that it has changed considerably.
Right. that's a really good analogy, because we think when we see a photograph in a textbook or a journal or somewhere like that, we think we're looking at a grape, but you're saying we might be looking at a raisin, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. I mean, nobody would claim that the grape had grooves on it, but a raisin certainly does.
Right,
and you
right.
wouldn't measure the width of the grooves because, you know, they're artifacts of dehydration.
Right, but if you have never seen a grape and all you've seen is a raisin, you might get quite excited about this on the outside and assume that they have a particular structure in the grape, which would be wrong because they don't actually exist until you've actually processed the fruit.
Precisely, yes.
You know, when I was in high school and university and learning about the cell structure, things like endoplasmic reticulum and mitochondria, you believe that one of those exists and the other is just an artifact.
No, the mitochondria exist because they can be seen in living cells moving. And right. They can also be seen in tissue cultures. But the endoplasmic reticulum is a complete artifact. And the reason we know it's an artifact is it only is seen in dehydrated cells. And it is flat. It is always in the plane of the picture. You understand? It doesn't appear at right angles to its normal plane. And that is simply right. Impossible.
Right. So that's a little bit hard for people to understand. I have to think about this a little bit. But if a cell is somewhat like a sphere, and if there is a flat object within the cell, if you randomly cut the cell, you were really lucky, you would cut right through the flat object. Sometimes you would cut at right angles to it and you just get a cross section, but often you would cut it at an angle. And so you would have an almost infinite variety of different ways of looking at the same object, depending on how it was cut.
And you'd be very surprised if it all appeared flat.
That would the odds of always cutting a spherical object so that a flat circular.
Well, they're millions to one. I mean, it just couldn't happen. We know, for example, if you take a solution of salt water and you dry it out, you get beautiful flat crystals formed. And these crystals are flat, and they don't. You don't look at them at right angles. They're just flat, and they're flat because you've dried it out. And they're drying
on
out
on a plane.
Yes.
So on a, you've dried it on a plane, right?
Exactly,
you've dried it
on a
flat object, like the bottom of a container.
Exactly, on a flat glass plate. Yes.
And the same thing is happening with a microscope where
Exactly.
Yes. And so what do you think the endoplasmic reticulum is then? I mean, it's an artifact, you think, but what?
Yes. Well, what it is, if you take the contents of any living cell, for example, a grape, and if you took the contents of that grape and you dried it out, it'll dry out in flat crystals.
Right.
And that's what it is. It's a crystalline structure which is deposited flat on the plane of the paper.
And what function has the endoplasmic reticulum being given by people who believe it's a real object? Like, what function is it believed to have?
They believe that it is involved in protein synthesis, but it can't be proved.
Right. Because you're seeing dead cells, so you can't study how a dead cell does anything.
Yes.
Even if what you were looking at was exactly what the cell looked like when it was alive, once it's dead, it can't do anything, so you can't see a process occurring.
Precisely. It has no chemistry when it's dead. You know, if you boiled it, it will dry out and it will be dead.
Yes, yes. Another thing I've been quite interested in is viruses like HIV. And the HIV virus is believed to be covered with little knobs that are made out of the protein. I believe it's GP120. And there are a few electron microscope photos that show this. How would you interpret... most don't, which is also interesting, but how would you, looking at an electron microscope, how would you know whether a virus particle was represented in the microscope or not?
Well, virus particle is like any other living tissue. It contains water. And if you dry it out, it contains a lot less water, and it'll distort its shape. And in fact, we don't know the shapes of any virus particles at all. Although it's generally believed we do, we just don't, because you have to dry them out to look at them.
And if it's claimed that virus particles all have a characteristic diameter and morphology. But if what we're seeing has been drastically dehydrated, then they wouldn't all be the same size.
Well, it is remarkable how uniform in size they are when you actually look at a group of them.
Right.
You would expect them to be a fair range of diameters and thicknesses and depths, but they aren't. They're remarkably uniform in diameter.
Right. Plus, if you sliced a fixed cell and sliced through viruses, it would be like randomly taking a knife to, say, a pumpkin. Sometimes you slice a little bit off the through the middle, and it would be much wider.
Yes.
So they wouldn't all be the same size if you were looking at a slice through them, because
no, they shouldn't. But in electron microscopy, very often you're not actually looking at sections when it comes to viruses. You're looking at deposits of they've been deposited on flat plane, so you'd expect them to be more uniform.
Right, but the it's remarkable to me that the dehydration process would produce the same size at the end if you started with the same size.
Yes.
But
I must say, to be quite honest, I don't know very much about viruses, but certainly the structures which I've characterized as artifacts are the endoplasmic reticulum, and
right.
the Golgi body, which was described in 1897,
right.
the so-called unit membrane. You know that according to every modern textbook in the world, the cell membrane is doubled. It's called the unit membrane.
Right. It's supposed to be two layers, right?
It's supposed to be two layers.
Mm-hmm.
And these two layers are always, and I repeat, always the same distance apart. Now, if you took an orange and you cut sections of it, the skin would appear different widths depending upon where you cut the sections.
Right.
And yet, the so-called unit membrane always appears the same distance apart. And you look at any textbook showing the cell membrane, the nuclear membrane or the mitochondrial membrane, and they're always the same distance apart. Now, that is simply impossible in geometry. I've said this in public in several hundred universities all over the world, and nobody has ever queried it. But it is a simple impossibility.
Right, so let's go back to the orange analogy, because an orange is nice because it has the orange skin, and then there's the white pith, which helps us maybe think better about what it would look like if we sliced it. So if you took a slice just off the top, what you would see is because you're cutting at a shallow angle, the orange skin would be quite thick, and the white would cover everything because you haven't cut it through.
Exactly.
You haven't gone through. But if you cut an orange right through the middle, the orange skin and the pith would be at their thinnest.
Exactly. And that is a simple fact of geometry which nobody can get away from. And although they may characterize me as a bit crackers, no electron microscopist has ever denied this, nor sent me a photograph of any cell in which there was a random range of thicknesses of these two lines, which compose the unit membrane.
So if our understanding of the cell membrane is wrong, I mean, these things accumulate, it seems like our entire understanding of the cell would be considerably wrong, because that's one of the fundamental ideas about the...
Well, I'll tell you, it's very simple. You take a piece of paper, and if you stain it, if you dip it in some ink and stain it, the stain will be on both sides of the piece of paper. So that when you cut sections of it and magnify them, every single real layer will appear as two lines.
Okay, so let me get this. If you dip a piece of paper in ink so that the ink doesn't have time to fully saturate the paper.
If you dip it in ink and you dry it,
right.
And then you cut a section of it,
right.
Every single piece of paper, every single real membrane will appear as two lines because the stain will stain on both sides of it.
So you're actually looking at the ink and thinking that that's a membrane as opposed
precisely,
to the
yes.
actual membrane that looks like empty space.
Yes. Yes, and there's a space between the two lines of ink because there's paper in between them.
Right, right. Okay, another thing. There's a lot of things that you question about cell structure. A lot of people talk about some kind of cellular, which is believed to be a fibrous system that organizes the cell, but you've said that it's not possible because the organelles, the objects within the cell, are bigger than the skeleton and therefore could not move around, and yet you can see them moving around if you look at living cells.
Exactly. If you take any living cell mm-hmm. and you look at it under the light microscope, living, for example, a cell in tissue culture or a unicellular organism or a plant or a fungus, you can actually see movements within the cell continuously. Now,
right.
if you dry them out, those movements stop. But
right.
I personally would prefer the view from the living cell because it is living, and I prefer it over the electron micrograph, which is a deposit of metal on a dead cell.
Right. I mean, what you're actually looking at on an electron microscope, I think this is an important point. You're not actually looking at anything that's cellular, because that would be invisible. What you're looking at is that are necessary to make things visible.
Yes. What you see in an electron micrograph, you emphasize never, because I've got pictures in my publications. You never look at a living cell. You
right.
You look at a metal deposit on a dead cell.
Right, but the cell itself is invisible, right? It's only the
exactly.
metal.
Exactly, it's invisible unless you put a metal deposit on it.
Right, and it's easy to confuse the two. So you might think because you're looking at the outline of something which is metal, you assume that that's the same as what it's covering, which is the actual cell. But in the case of the membrane, you think you're looking at two things when you're actually looking at two deposits of metal on either side of a single object.
Exactly, exactly. The other point which is worth making is that if you look at any living cell, and there have been hundreds of measurements of the viscosity of the cytoplasm, and
right.
the viscosity of the cytoplasm has usually been about less than that of 10% solution of glycerin. It's very low. In other words, the cytoplasm in life is a liquid.
Right.
What people say, well, isn't it possible that things like mitochondria and Golgi bodies and all these objects actually go through the membrane, the weave of the membrane? And the answer
right.
is no, it isn't possible, because they are about 10 times the width of the membrane.
That somebody had postulated that maybe these fibers dissolve and then reform every time something moves, but that seems a bit unlikely.
Well, that would be true, except that you never, ever see space but after the thing has moved along where it hasn't yet reformed.
Right, right. You said that for some time, maybe I think in the 1970s, there was a theory that there was an even finer mesh within the cell that you said were called microtrabeculae.
That's right.
But that hypothesis vanished without a trace after a short time.
Yes, there was a man called Porter, and another chap called Walasiewicz, who worked with them, and they described these microtrabeculae. And at an international conference, I asked both of them how it was possible that granules could be moving around living cells, because he was actually looking at cells in tissue culture. I asked him how it was possible that granules could be moving around if there was a very fine structure, the microtrabeculae, in its place, and he couldn't answer it. In fact, he wouldn't even discuss it with me. You know, there is no answer. It is not possible.
Yes.
So, I mean, just to summarize this point, the reason why the endoplasmic reticulum and the lysosomes and any other structure except the mitochondria can't exist in life is one, because in life you've got continuous movement within the living cells. The viscosity of the cytoplasm is quite low, and it is impossible, and I repeat, impossible, to make a three-dimensional model of a living cell in which the endoplasmic reticulum was present and the Golgi body was present, because they just couldn't move around if there were a network there.
I wanted to talk about some of the things that do exist in the cell. You certainly don't question that the nucleus and the mitochondria do exist. The nucleus, of course, contains.
Yes. Well, these can be seen in living cells. That's the point. In living cells which are not fixed, not stained, not dehydrated, not heated, not cooled, anything. They just look at living cells. We take out drops of water from ponds, and you look at them under the light microscope, and you can see there's movement in the cytoplasm. And that is not possible if there was such a reticulum there.
One thing I wanted to ask you about the mitochondria is whether the shape you see under an electron microscope is at all similar to the shape you see on a living cell, since you can see the mitochondria there.
There is a fundamental difference. In the electron microscope, you see what are called cristae, which are really shelves. These shelves cross the mitochondria, and they can be seen very clearly by the electron microscope. The trouble is that they all appear as shelves. They appear side on, and you never get a random selection of views side on, flat, and oblique, which you should get if they were three-dimensional. And I'm quite sure that there is, in fact, a substance which I call mitochondrioplasm, which is a liquid which dries out when they prepare it for electron microscopy, and it looks like these strands, these cristae, which are seen in the mitochondria.
Just apologize for the slight delay. I'm having a little trouble with my audio. One thing that you do not believe exists, I believe, or based on reading what you wrote, was ribosome, which is believed to contain RNA, which is obviously very important. But you made the point that these are not found in muscle cells.
I didn't hear the first word. Which wasn't found in muscle cells? Sorry, can you repeat that question? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm having difficulty with the connection. I about ribosomes. Do you believe that they actually exist?
Which two? Ribosomes, you say? I didn't hear the first word.
Yes.
Ribosomes. Is that what you were asking about?
Okay.
No, I didn't quite get that question, I'm afraid.
Yes, can you connect me? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Dr. Hillman, there was some problems with the audio. So I don't know if you got my question about the ribosomes, but they...
Oh, the ribosomes, yes. Oh, yes. The question of ribosomes. A ribosome is a granule. And they're too small to make out their shape. And I do not believe that they exist because there are many cells, for example, muscle cells, which you don't see ribosomes. And if these this function can be taken over by structures which you can't see, how do you know that when you can see a structure, it is performing that function?
Right, right. So presumably RNA, which is supposed to be what our ribosomes are related or involved, would be very important in muscle cells. And so if there's no ribosomes in muscle cells, then, like you say, something else would have to perform this function. But then that's something invisible, and the question is, if there's something invisible in muscle cells doing the job, then why isn't there the same invisible thing in the other cell?
Precisely, exactly. People don't seem to realize, this relates to another question, which I haven't got time to take up in this program, but my first book in 1972, I showed that subcellular fractionation was illegal. You know what subcellular fractionation?
Illegal?
Yes. What they do is they take a piece of, say, liver, and they homogenize it and centrifuge it. You see?
Right.
When you homogenize and centrifuge anything, you change its entropy. Now, I don't know if you know what entropy is. You probably do, don't you? You change its order. You change its order. In other words, if you take a potato and you mash it, it tastes different than if it's not mashed, because you've changed its chemistry by mashing it up. And I showed in my first book that subcellular fractionation, by which we define what happens in each part of the cell, is simply illegal according to the second law of thermodynamics. But that's another question that I could take up, but I think I won't at the moment. It's rather complicated.
But maybe a simpler way to look at it is that when you homogenize something, you're breaking up a lot of cells, and so there may be substances that start to dissolve other things or just to start to change the form of other things.
Very simply, you change its chemistry. And we are examining its chemistry. If you mash a potato, it tastes different, even with your eyes closed. Or if you if you centrifuge, or if you homogenize things, they taste different. The very fact they taste different.
Also, yes, I mean, if we follow the potato analogy, the different ways of preparing potatoes, like you can get dehydrated mashed potatoes, but that tastes quite different. And I'm sure that most people could tell the difference between potatoes that were freshly mashed and those that were reconstituted from a dehydrated format.
Yes, even with their eyes closed.
As well.
Even if they're with their eyes closed, because you actually do change the chemistry. I mean, we know lots and lots of examples in cookery of how the effects of centrifugation and of homogenization on things you eat because they change the taste.
So when the people are preparing, when scientists are preparing things, they often go through a process. Like, for example, cell culturing, you might take some cells and add maybe a viral solution to those cells, and then you allow that to sit with some process going on, a bunch of chemicals added. Then you take the liquid, and you might put that liquid through a filter, and then you centrifuge it, which is basically to spin it at an extremely high speed so things would separate with different densities. And one of the comments you made is that at each step of that process, you should have a control to see how things are changed, such as the chemistry of the cells at each step.
Precisely,
and if things are changed in a drastic way, the process should not be used.
Precisely, exactly. I mean, it's a simple fact that the second law of thermodynamics tells us that you must not homogenize or centrifuge if you want to describe the chemistry, because the chemistry is changed by virtue of the homogenization and the centrifugation.
And is it possible that centrifugation would do nothing more than sort particles into basically different sizes, and so that when you look at a particular density and see objects of a particular size, that's actually an artifact of the centrifugation?
No, because when you centrifuge them, you heat them. And it is the heat, among other things, which causes the biochemical changes in them.
Right, but I guess what I'm saying is, if you took a bunch of identical particles, of chemically identical particles, membrane-wrapped particles, that just differed in their diameter, and you centrifuged them, would they sort differently based on their diameter?
Yes, because when you centrifuge them, you heat them. And heat, of course,
right,
causes chaos in the chemistry.
Right. Also, is the density of the membrane presumably is significantly different than the density of the internals of an organelle?
Do I see what? I didn't hear that.
Is the density of the membrane, the cell membrane, very different than the density of what's inside a vesicle or something, or some kind of organelle, like the cytoplasm?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you can't subject a thing to an enormous amount of energy and expect it to not to change its shape and its chemistry.
Right. Some other things that you talked about in some of the documents you sent to me that you think are myths are not objects, but hypothesized mechanisms. Two of them you referred to as ion pumps, as ION, and molecular motors. And these are things that are supposed to use energy to transport materials into and out of the cell. And why do you not believe these exist?
Well, first of all, most people except me believe that there are enzymes in the cell membrane which pump these things in and out of the cell. The trouble is these enzymes have been characterized by electron microscopists and by chemists, and they are three times as wide as the membrane itself. And yet the membrane is as smooth as a baby's bottom. The membrane simply does not have lots of little knobs on it. And if there was a pump there, there would have to be these molecules sitting in the membrane and pumping it out. And they would have to be seen by electron microscopy.
Okay, so you think a membrane is basically like a piece of plastic, a very smooth, thin border to a cell, and there's no space in it for anything complicated?
No, exactly.
And so there are other mechanisms to get things across the boundary, because obviously what's inside the cell and the cytoplasm is considerably different than what's outside. So there has to be a way to get things in and out.
Well, just consider this problem. You know what an ion exchange resin is. It is a resin which, for example, likes sodium, but doesn't like potassium. Now, if you put some ion exchange resin in a mixture, it'll prefer to take the sodium and not the potassium. So it will cause a gradient of sodium and potassium. And that's essentially my model of it. It's the same model as...
Right, and does that... I'm sorry, I should let you finish.
Well, my model is the same as that of Gilbert Ling, who's a very well-known biophysicist who's been saying this for a long time.
And does that process require energy, the process that you're...
Not necessarily. I mean, if the ion exchange resin likes sodium, sodium will be naturally attracted to it. And if it doesn't like potassium, potassium won't be attracted to it.
Right. So your solution to a lot of these problems is to work on living cells, although you've pointed out that when people do this, they're often working in vitro in a test tube, a petri dish or something like that, where there are still significant differences from actually looking at cells in a living animal or plant or something like that.
You're quite right that if you take a cell in tissue culture, in other words, you grow cells, they are different than they are in the ordinary adult organism. And we know that because they change their shape and they change their sizes, and their chemistry is exactly decided by the chemistry in which they're grown. You know,
which is often extremely artificial.
Yes, exactly. But they are alive. And that's more than can be said for electron micrograph.
Right. So you're quite a bit closer to actually seeing what's going on in a living organism if you're looking at living cells. But you still have to be somewhat skeptical about what you're seeing.
Yes, definitely.
Because it's not exactly the same.
No, exactly.
There are things like in some cell cultures, there are things called synctitia, which are giant cells that are sometimes formed, and those are, as far as I know, are not ever found in living organisms.
Yes. Sorry, I didn't get the beginning of the sentence.
There are objects called synctitia, S-Y-N-C-T-I-A. Well, for example, in AIDS research, they have found these giant cells in cell cultures, but nobody has ever found them in living organisms. So it's believed that the HIV virus causes the creation of these cells, but they've never been seen in living organisms, so it's all quite speculative.
That's not impossible. I must say I'm afraid I don't know anything about HIV, so I don't like to talk about it, but it's quite possible.
Okay, no problem.
Pardon?
There's no problem. I don't want you to try to make you talk about things that you haven't done research into.
Yes, well, that's
one
true.
Of the things that I did want to talk to you about is the reaction to your work. I mean, you're questioning the fundamentals of cell structure. Based on that, there's a lot of science that is based on the sort of the general understanding of how the cell works.
Yes.
So have journals been interested in publishing your work or resistance?
They haven't, and I've had a struggle going on for 40 years to get them published. I've got nearly all of them published in the end, but they're mostly small publishers, and they're very often not reviewed. And if they're not reviewed, they don't exist because nobody buys them. but I'd like to just summarize for you really how the system has reacted. First of all, nobody has said that the cell membrane does not appear to be composed of a unit which is composed of two lines which are equally distant apart. Nobody has said that. Secondly, nobody has alleged that it is possible for particles to move around if there were a network there. Thirdly, there are supposed to be holes in the nucleus, but nobody can tell me how the cytoplasm and the nucleoplasm would not short-circuit if there were holes in the nucleus. Fourthly, the synapse is another question, and it's not complicated, but I have alleged that synapses also don't exist. And nobody has shown me a picture of any presynaptic fiber of any nerve cell in the world. And I've challenged them several times. And I wrote an important paper a few years ago with a colleague, and they just won't publish it. But they give no reason. It's been to about 10 of the best possible journals, and they all reject it with no reason at all. And that makes me a bit angry.
So I think you're saying a number of important things here. I mean, first, you're saying that major journals, let's talk about Science and Nature, they have published none of your ideas?
No, they won't publish my ideas.
And you said the journals you published in have not been reviewed. Do you mean they're not peer reviewed?
My books haven't been reviewed, and because the books haven't been, they don't exist because they don't sell. And if a book doesn't sell,
so
it doesn't have any influence.
Right. If you publish a scientific book that gets a book review in the New England Journal of Medicine, Science, Nature, Journal of the American Medical Association, it's going to sell a lot better than if there's total silence when the book is published.
Well, you say
because
that
only experts in the field would ever find it.
But my latest big book, which was 2006, nobody has reviewed it. It came out in 2006. Not one single review has appeared. Another big book I published on the structure of the brain was published in 1985, and that wasn't reviewed either.
I think that does two things. First of all, people don't hear about the book, and secondly, a book review is an implicit endorsement. Even if it's not a perfectly good review, it's still somewhat of an endorsement that the ideas are worth looking at. If they're worth reviewing in Science or Nature, they're worth reading.
Yes,
and if they're not reviewed, that implies that they're not worth.
Yes. Well, I mean, last week, I published quite a lot. I published about 150 full-length papers and six books. And last week, my most important paper, which I submitted to Nature, was rejected within 24 hours without any reason being given. And it's my most important paper because I take a completely different view of biology, biological research and medical research. And they just would not review it and would not give any reason. And that's been my experience over a long period of time.
I would think that most people who have heard about science through popular channels would believe that if there was any revolutionary idea that it would be embraced, maybe not embraced by journals, but they would fall over themselves to publish the new idea in order to get discussion going, because it's supposedly through discussion of ideas that revolutions in science occur. But you've encountered a wall of censorship of your ideas.
Yes. Well, the reason is very obvious, because if you become a world expert in the structure of the cell and somebody challenges it, you are not going to admit, you're not going to encourage the publication of something which challenges it, because it means that your work isn't of such fundamental value. So you have an interest in not publishing it. And that, I'm afraid, has been my experience.
What areas of science, if your ideas about the cell were accepted, what areas of science would be, or biological science would be fundamentally useless following the acceptance? Like histology, for example, you're basically saying has very limited utility.
I'll tell you, electron microscopy will be quite out because it examines dead cells. Histology,
right.
Histochemistry, subcellular fractionation. There are others, but those are the main ones.
And there are probably thousands of scientists working in those areas.
Precisely.
And there are certainly millions of dollars every year, probably more than that, being spent on those areas. So it would be, you can understand why there would be resistance. But on the other hand, if science is supposed to be a search for truth, then the fact that somebody might lose status or lose their job or lose their grants shouldn't really stand in the way of searching for truth.
Precisely. You see, I quote a Russian saying that it is easier to get on the back of a tiger than to get off it. And once you have become famous, you know, on the endoplasmic reticulum, you have to believe it. And the only way you can get around it is when somebody asks you a question, you dodge it. And I'm afraid that's happened for years and years. You mentioned the microtrabeculae. Well, there was a man called Porter who invented them. And I spoke to him at several conferences, and he didn't want to talk to me about it. I spoke to De Duve, you know, Christian De Duve, of the lysosomes. And he's very polite, but he didn't want to talk about it. And I've spoken to several well-known people, and they just get embarrassed. They run away.
That's actually interesting, because I did focus on what the journals do. But I think that's an important point, that the response of scientists to your ideas, the scientists in the area that are affected by your ideas, is not to get angry, not to yell and scream and write papers saying that you don't know what you're talking about. The response is a wall of silence to avoid the discussion.
Precisely.
Implies that they know.
That is my opinion. I mean, I've challenged several of them to a public debate. In fact, in 1977, I challenged the Royal Microscopical Society about the electron microscope. And I challenged them, and since 1977, two such debates have occurred, one in London and another in Sydney. But most of them just run away. You know, they say,
yeah,
oh, I've got a bee in my bonnet, or I'm crackers or something. But they just run away, and that's not good enough.
Right. And what keeps you going all these years in the wilderness with difficulty getting your ideas published?
Well, what really keeps me going is that, firstly, I've been quite ill. I've had heart trouble for 26 years, and I'm full of electronic apparatus. But the reason I'm so determined is because they won't engage. And if they won't engage, to my mind, it proves that I'm likely to be right. I mean, I've had discussions with Ernest Chain, you know, who invented penicillin. Well, he didn't invent it, he extracted it. And
right.
I've had discussions with Krebs, and I've had discussions
right.
with Tadouf, and they all run away.
Right. Which I guess you keep hoping that one day there will be a debate that changes things. What, in your opinion, what errors are likely to be caused by an erroneous model of the cell? I mean, a lot of this, the model of the cell is used in medical research and the development
yes.
of drugs, things like that. Do you have any idea how medical research or things like that would change if the how the cell works?
One fairly substantial example. If we look at multiple sclerosis or cancer
right.
or schizophrenia or
right.
Any of these well-known diseases, you wouldn't believe that nobody
right.
has looked at them by light microscopy in living cells. They've always used the electron microscope in dead cells. And you,
right.
and I have advocated in my last book that we, I've made a long list of these diseases and suggested that some people should look at them in living cells. And I believe that
I understand what you're saying is that you don't really know. I mean, there's differences between diseased cells and healthy cells under the electron microscope, but you don't really know what the significance of that is. And if you see differences between living cells, that would probably tell you a lot more and might actually help resolve the problem or
yes.
find better therapies or something.
Precisely, yes. Yes, I mean, I've listed about 20 diseases, and I can't find any of them. I did do some work on multiple sclerosis myself when I was active
right.
in the laboratory, but I retired in 1995, and so I didn't have much time to do that.
Yes, yes. Are there other? Do you have other ideas about how long the ideas have been carried forward based on the idea of how the cell works or how erroneous ideas have had an impact on the world of medicine or other areas?
Well, if you consider that electron microscopy, in my view, is a waste of money and time, and you consider, when I last inquired in 1977, there were 1,200 electron microscopes used in medical research in Britain alone. In the United States, there must be thousands. So all those people are simply wasting their time. If you consider subcellular fractionation, probably 50% of all research work in biochemical cytology uses subcellular fractionation, and although people got the Nobel Prize for it, it completely ignores the second law of thermodynamics, and they can't get away from that. And they, when I challenge them to it, they don't change the subject. They don't want to know.
So a couple of things you're saying. One is that there is a misallocation of resources, because an electron microscope is not a cheap object. And so if we're buying electron microscopes for biology as opposed to other areas such as semiconductor physics, where they could be quite useful, there could be a lot of electron microscopes being purchased. And then, of course, you have to hire fairly expensive staff to actually use them, and that could all be...
Yes, and consumables as well. you know, the
Yes. So you have a lot of expensive materials that are needed to prepare specimens. You have technicians. You have a bunch of PhDs who have to do the interpretation, as well as the electron microscope. So there's a lot of resources. But secondly, what you're also saying is that when you look at the chemistry of fractionated cells and draw conclusions from that, it's like drawing conclusions from a stew about the animal that was killed to make the stew.
Exactly. I mean, that's my case, really. It's much more complicated than that, but in essence, they're using energetic procedures which change the things more than the differences they're looking for. And that is one of my main contentions. Yes.
It would also mean that if you... that slight differences in procedures between laboratories, that people in different laboratories might prefer to use different reagents to fix, to do the preparation, whether it's fractionation or electron microscopy or something. I'm sure that the precise methodology varies between laboratories and institutions, and that would mean that the work was not necessarily comparable.
Yes,
and
exactly.
When you look at two things from two different labs, you don't know if you're looking at a difference in methodology or at an actual difference in the cells.
It would, exactly. I did my PhD on brain slices and under a world expert in brain slices. But each of the people who did them slightly different ways, and they'd get different answers. And that's no good. I mean, because to any biological problem, by definition, there could only be one answer.
And so today you wouldn't do brain slices?
No. I did my PhD on them, and several years later I concluded that they were a waste of time, and I wrote a chapter in one of my books saying exactly why they were a waste of time.
Which takes quite a bit of courage, because you were basically saying that you had thought at the time you were doing something really important, but when you looked back, you realized that it was a waste of time, although maybe not a waste of time, because you learned a lot about how the process of extracting a sample can actually change it in ways that
I'll tell you exactly why they're a waste of time. You wouldn't actually believe it was as simple as this. If you cut a brain slice, when you cut it, you compress it, so you change its weight.
Right.
And then when you put it in incubation, it changes its weight continuously. Now, if it changes its weight, then anything like the potassium or the sodium or the oxygen uptake or anything in it must be wrong, because it changes its weight all the time. So you can't study changes in the chemistry of a brain slice.
You've brought up so many fascinating things today. I wish we had another hour to talk about the brain, because you've also written a lot about brain structure. I'm hearing the music that brings us to the end of the show. I would like to really thank you for sharing your ideas, and I will include on the in the show notes a link to your website, so that if people are interested in finding out more about how our ideas about the cell may be drastically wrong, they can follow up. Thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Good. Yes, I hope it was understandable, because it's quite difficult. The sound isn't very good, is it?
Yes, there were some problems with the sound, but generally it was excellent. I understood just about everything you said, so thank you.